Well, it's 10 a.m., and I guess it's time to do the program now. I don't hear the introductory music, but I'm real happy to be with you. This is Dr. Z, along with our illustrious guest, which we'll bring on in a second, Mr. Mark Blumenthal. But I usually do the program here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z with The Natural Nurse. She has the day off, Ellen Kamai, and we're really glad to bring you information on health, wellness, and issues in alternative medicine today. Again, you can get more information on our website, naturalnurse.com and drznaturally.com. But we're really excited to have our guest to start off the new year. I was telling him that I like this to be a tradition with Mark Blumenthal, the Herbal Cowboy, and he's the founder and executive director of the American Botanical Council, a leading independent research and educational profit organization dedicated to disseminating accurate, reliable, and responsible information on herbs, medicinal plants, teas, essential oils, phytomedicines, beneficial plants, and edible and medicinal fungi. Blumenthal is editor-in-chief and publisher of Herbalgram magazine. It's actually a journal, ABC's international peer-reviewed quarterly journal. For 6 years, he served as an adjunct associate professor of medicinal chemistry at U Texas Austin College of Pharmacy, and he taught a course called Herbs and Phytomedicines in Today's Pharmacy. He's the founder and director of a botanical adulterants prevention program, which we'll be talking about today, a nonprofit international consortium committed to extensively researching and exposing adulteration and fraud in botanical ingredients, which are sold worldwide on the global market. He's senior editor of the Complete German Commission E Monographs, Therapeutic Guide to Herbal Medicines, which is a 715-page reference book published in 1998, one of the great seminal publications. He received the American Society of Pharmacognosy Varro E. Tyler Award. I'll tell you about a tie I got from Dr. Tyler. And in 2018, he was named Outstanding International Ethnopharmacologist by the Indian Society for Ethnopharmacology, appearing on more than 400 radio and TV shows and writing more than 500 articles, reviews, book chapters, and forwards. He is the Natural Health Hall of Fame Award. And we're so happy that he got into herbs, you know, 50 or so years ago, and has brought this to the forefront of, I think, all types of people know about herbs because of Mark Blumenthal's work. Herbal Cowboy, how are you?
I'm supernatural. Thank you, Gene, and thank you, Dr. Z, for including me in your show again. It's good to see you again. Thanks for inviting me in. And by the way, one quick thing, just thank you for that nice introduction. We are a nonprofit organization at the American Botanical Council. I wasn't sure you said a profit organization. In case there's any confusion, we are an independent, nonprofit, tax-exempt research and education organization, and thanks for supporting our work.
Yes, sorry about that. I must have just slipped up.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not profiting on this. Well, I am. I'm having a good time. That's my profit.
Yeah, that's interesting. So how did you take being like, you know, an herbal cowboy growing up in Texas, and how did you found the ABC back in the day? I just tell you a story. When I was at Bastyr University, I remember getting this really cool newsletter in the library, which was called Herbalgram, and I was glued to it. And I remember saving each copy, and it was great to be reading this cutting edge stuff as I was studying to be a naturopathic doctor. Let's see, I started Bastyr in 85, I think. So around 85, 86, I think, is when you launched your work.
You know, it's a pleasure to talk to somebody with as long-term memory as you have, institutional memory. I actually, Rob McCaleb at Celestial Seasonings Laboratories, and I started Herbalgram in July of 1983. Oh, so we are now in our 40th year of publication. Originally, HerbalGram was a newsletter we started for two organizations that Rob and I both had started at the time with other people. We started the Herb Research Foundation, which was a research organization, and we also were founding board members of what's called the American Herbal Products Association, APA, which has just completed its 40th year, which is an industry trade association, because back in those days, I had a wholesale herb company called Sweetheart Herbs, and Rob was the head of research at Celestial Seasonings Herb Tea Company. So we started this trade association, which we had been involved with a previous trade association called the Herb Trade Association back in the 70s. So my history going back in herb industry infrastructure and herb community infrastructure goes back, 45 years probably at this point, at least. So the point was that we started HerbalGram as a newsletter because remember, back in 1983, we didn't have internet. We didn't even have faxes. I mean, some businesses may have had early stage faxes, but we didn't have one until a little later. So if you wanted to get information out to your friends and colleagues, which we did, we started a newsletter, which we had printed at a small print shop, several hundred copies. It was 8 pages, and then it grew to 12 pages, and then it was 16 pages, black and white, but on black on cream colored paper. And we would put latest research information and market information and regulatory information for friends of ours who were in academia as well as in industry. And it's a few in government, like Jim Duke, who I'd met in 77 back in the day, and the late great Jim Duke. And what happened was we were just disseminating this information through this newsletter for 5 years. For the American Herbal Products Association, a trade association, and the Herb Research Foundation, which was a research and education organization. And I got the point where I just said, you know, what I want to do with my life, I'd gotten out of the business. I didn't have a wholesale business anymore. I wasn't selling herbs. And my real passion was communication, education, learning, advocacy, trying to create a better world through natural medicine from plants and fungi. But at the same time, helping to increase the communication among people in the community that were processing, purchasing, growing, harvesting, producing, researching medicinal natural medicines for the benefit of everyone who could benefit from natural medicine. And so what I did is I started the American Botanical Council as a nonprofit organization to take HerbalGram, that newsletter that you were reading at the Bastyr Library in 85 and 86. Yeah. And in 1988, after five years of producing HerbalGram as a newsletter, I started ABC, the organization, strictly as a vehicle, a nonprofit vehicle, to take that newsletter and try to energize it and resource it in with donations. We were a nonprofit, so that we could create a scientific American or national geographic style publication that people would enjoy each issue, but at the same time would help lend more credibility by having beautiful photography. And for 60 covers of our, we're working on issue number 137, we're quarterly. 60 of our covers were produced from photographs by the late Stephen Foster.
Yeah,
and I want to take a shout out to Stephen right now, because today we're recording this on January 17th, 2023, 1 year and 1 day from the date that Stephen Foster passed suddenly and unexpectedly.
Amazing.
And so his yard site was yesterday. So we're on the cusp of, just on the back end of the his first anniversary of his passing. He was a dear friend, an incredible self-taught botanist, author, encyclopedic and photographic memory of the herbal literature going back into the 1700s, an astonishing mind, without a college education, by the way.
Wow.
He was not formally educated. He started his herbal education at the Shaker Herb Farm up in Sabbath Day Lake, Maine, right out of high school. Anyway, Stephen was a dear friend, on the board of the American Botanical Council for 23 years and president of the board for 10 years. So even though he was like one of my best friends, he was also my boss technically, because chairman of the board is my boss, because that's how nonprofits run, right? So anyway, I just want to acknowledge that. But so the point about HerbalGram was, We had all this great photography because Stephen was probably the world's preeminent botanical photographer. He could capture the light around medicinal plants like nobody who had come before him, probably. And his photo archives are incredible. And we still use his photography in Herbalgram. And I, you know, the greatest, one of the greatest compliments, Dr. Z, that I received on Herbalgram about 5 years ago, we received a donation from somebody in the mail. And they wrote a note and they said, my wife and I, we recycle all of our magazines, good for you, except for two, National Geographic and Herbalgram.
Oh, I love it.
Because every issue is a collector's item. Every issue is peer-reviewed and accurate and hardly any typos or anything like that. But it, you know, it's all four-color with beautiful four-color photography, much of it coming from Stephen Foster's photo archives. And we cover, you know, ethnobotany, traditional historical use, modern research, clinical research, market trends, regulatory issues, quality control issues, sustainability and conservation related issues. And we've been reporting on these things since 1983, 40 years. Yeah. And then the organization grew from Herbalgram. We're still herbalgram.org as our website based on our publication, Herbalgram. But we have all these other programs and projects and publications. We have six cyclical publication or periodical publications from our different different programs. And then we also publish extensive peer-reviewed technical papers on adulteration and fraud, laboratory guidance documents for industry and government laboratories so they can know which lab methods they should or shouldn't use to help authenticate the identity of certain herbs or help detect the potential fraud. Because the fraudsters, and we're getting ahead of ourselves probably, but the fraudsters are actually trying to game the system. You know, people have always cheated, right? The first article we published in our Botanical Adulterants Prevention Program was about the history, by Stephen Foster, back in 2012, was the history, a brief history of the adulteration of herbs, spices, and botanical drugs. Botanical drugs, meaning back in the day when a lot of drugs were made from plants. Hence the word drug, because they dried the plant, and the word drug is from an old Dutch word to dry.
Right.
Whole concept, right? Droog, yeah. Whole concept behind drug was dried plant back in the day. Mm-hmm. And since Greco-Roman times and even before, we have evidence, and we put this in the article. It's a fantastic read. Anybody should read it. It's free access on the ABC site. At herbalgram.org, all you have to do is register and get the article for free. But people have been cheating, and we've documented it since Greco-Roman time over 2,000 years ago. So this problem about adulteration and fraud that we see in the marketplace is unfortunate. It doesn't characterize the whole herbal market, but it's there, and it's always been there. And we have the problem with olive oil, and we have it with wine, and we have it with all kinds of foods and natural products, and et cetera. People cheat, and it's our job not only to report the good news of the research that keeps continually supporting the safety and the many of the benefits that historically have been documented over time with many herbs and new benefits that have not been historically documented because they're new, they're based on modern research. But we're also at the same time not only banging the drum to communicate to people the value propositions of natural herbal medicines and fungal-based medicines, but we're also working to help the industry, the people who collect and process and sell the plant materials into products, whether they be teas or extracts or capsules or tablets or cosmetic ingredients and external ingredients. We help them ensure that their laboratories know how to detect the fraudulent material that's being brought in from any places around the world where people are trying to find a way to make an extra buck through what we call economically motivated adulteration. That's the FDA's term for this, EMA, economically motivated adulteration, because people cheat because they can make money at it.
So it's like throwing a little sawdust in the ground up herb to try to bulk up the weight and put something inert or something even toxic, I would assume. Sometimes you find those types of things when you analyze herbs. What generally do companies do? Take us through the manufacturing process. I think people would be interested. Like, how does like, you know, they go to their health food store and they see tinctures, they see capsules, they see standardized extract. Of course, teas and things like that as well are used, you know, ethnobotanically around the world. But there's a long process of which happens from the farmer all the way to the herb company, or and then beyond in the health food store to the consumer. And many different parts of that, there could be adulteration.
Let me just say first that there's many good companies out there that are owned and or managed by responsible, ethical people with a conscience who care about the benefits to their consumer. They care about the consumer's experience being positive. Excuse me. And they want to make sure that their products have the best quality ingredients, the most authentically confirmed ingredients as possible. First of all, so there's a lot of good companies out there, not to worry. The problem is there's a bad apple in the barrel once in a while, and there's lots of barrels. And this thing about putting sawdust in the herb to bulk up the weight with inert material that's cheap, or back in the day, put sand in the cinnamon or whatever.
Oh.
You know, back in the first century, Dioscorides, the famous Greek physician to, I think it was Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, Dioscorides did an herbal that was one of the most important books in the development of Western culture for 1,500 years, save the, you know, next to the Bible. And Dioscorides even had a thing in there that is the basis of the modern ASH test that you've seen in these pharmacopeia monographs about how to analyze and various plant materials, where you burn the material, and what's left, the sand, if there's sand in there, doesn't burn. It's called the ASH test. You burn the organic stuff, and you have so much weight. You put so much weight into the thing, and you burn it. You weigh it again. You know, the burn stuff is gone, but the sand is still there. Now, that goes back 2,000 years, that test, which shows that this is a historical issue. People have cheated. It's part of human nature, unfortunately, or it's part of society. But there's many good people out there, and there's rules on how to handle things. Starting with the field and collection and growing, there's good agricultural and collection practices that people can follow. The World Health Organization has set some of those practices up. The American Herbal Products Association, the Industry Trade Association, which I referred to earlier, which is just celebrated its 40th anniversary, which tend to be, you know, the good guys in the industry, the people who care about following the rules and helping make the rules. Because sometimes the Industry Trade Association knows so much about the industry and so much about what's going on that they are ahead of the Food and Drug Administration. They're ahead of the government and the regulators because the guys in the industry tend to be the experts. The way it is. So there's good agricultural collection practices. There's good manufacturing practices, which are required by FDA, by law. And these GMPs, good manufacturing practices, require that if a company is buying an herb to make a capsule or tablet out of it, they have to test that herb material when it comes in. Before it even comes into the factory, it's quarantined in a certain part of the warehouse or sometimes a separate building, depending on the size of the company. And that material stays in quarantine until proper sampling can be made, not just from the top of the barrel if they have five barrels, but there's certain rules about how you sample material to make sure that the stuff on the top isn't the good stuff, and then 80% of the stuff just below that top level is stuff that's adulterated or diluted or something else. There's certain rules and ways to sample, and there's certain tools that you sample with that you can stick something into a barrel of powder and get something from the middle or the bottom. And then you take it to the lab and you look at it macroscopically from taste, color, smell, visual issues. That if it's, especially if it's whole plant material, but very few companies buy whole plant material. They buy either powders or extracts. Or a lot of companies just order the stuff already made from a contract manufacturer, and they never even get involved with the manufacturing. They're just marketing companies. A lot of the business, this is true not just for herbs and supplements, but it's true for cosmetics and many other goods in this country, are made through contract manufacturers that put your label on something, or you can, and it's their basic product, or it could be something you've customized and they made it for you custom according to your specifications. Sometimes, unfortunately, the biggest specification is price, which is not the most important specification. It shouldn't be the most important specification, but unfortunately, sometimes it is, because people are just looking for ways to cut costs and make profit. And that's when you get in trouble, because you start buying by price. That's when the adulterators start getting your attention, because they've got something there that is not what they claim it to be. The key about adulteration is it's the seller has either switched the material and saying that what they're selling is A, but it's really B, or they're selling A with some B mixed in it to reduce, and B is cheaper material, and they've mixed it in and diluted it, but they don't tell you that, because part of adulteration is non-disclosure, concealment. The seller knows what's going on, but the buyer doesn't. And the issue is that it's to the economic benefit of the seller and the economic detriment to the buyer. They don't know that they're getting something that, unless they do the proper testing. And the first test is for identity. You must test to make sure that what you're buying is what it claims to be, what the seller claims it to be. And the second test is for purity. Make sure that it's not contaminated with industrial chemicals or agricultural chemicals or
mold
or microorganisms. Right. Exactly. Or if it's an extract with excessive solvent residues in some cases. So there's different rules, and there's rules about this. Now, what happens is that sometimes people don't do the proper identity testing because they don't know. And here's the big, we have a big paper coming out shortly in a major journal on this very subject, because we've published close to 80 extensively peer-reviewed documents that confirm the adulteration of certain types of herbs that are popular in the marketplace. It doesn't mean those herbs are always adulterated. It means they're subject to adulteration. Some of the popular herbs are subject to adulteration, because a fraudster in China or whatever is not going to spend the time to adulterate something that's not going to be popular and there's no market for it. They go after the stuff that sells, especially if it tends to be a high price item. There's room to try to cheat. And again, I don't want to create a negative picture to the consumer and your viewers here, because there's lots of really good companies that are run by really excellent and thoughtful and ethical and responsible people. But it happens that sometimes somebody might get the wrong stuff. So what happens is that we look at all the analytical methods published in the scientific literature on the herbs that we've confirmed are being adulterated. We've published like 26 bulletins confirming adulteration, like 16 of these laboratory guidance documents so far. And we show companies and independent laboratories and lab technicians at government laboratories, anybody who wants to look at our stuff, it's free access for anybody around the world. We're the largest nonprofit consortium doing research and education in the world on this subject, on helping to authenticate and educate stakeholders in the industry and government and academia on what's being adulterated and how to properly test for it. Because some of the analytical tests are being tricked or gamed by the fraudsters. They're seeing, okay, they're using this method. We can put some of this chemicals that are naturally from a cheaper plant that we've extracted or synthetically created, whatever, we can put that into this extract. And if they're just going to use a certain method, X, Y, or Z, they'll end up authenticating and giving a positive for the identity of this material when in fact it's not authentic. It's fraudulent. So they're gaming the system.
So when they do like the mass spectroscopy or gas chromatography, I remember in organic chemistry, looking at the peaks and whatever. So different chemicals give like different peaks, and there's all kinds of books published on that. So they can actually find something that's fake to show that peak. Wow, that's and fool PhD physicists and chemists, I guess, huh?
Analytical chemists can be fooled by the addition of certain They can take extracts from certain plants, like with that are the blue purple pigment plants that are anthocyanins. They can take black rice or black soybean. It's called black. It's really dark blue purple, right? It's got anthocyanins, these pigment, these antioxidant beneficial pigments that have this purple blue color. And they can take get anthocyanins from various cheap food, like the so-called black soybean and black rice, and put it into so-called bilberry extract. And based on certain types of analytical methodology, it'll show similar peaks. And if you don't have the right kind of method and the right kind of reading of the method, you can get fooled.
Wow.
And they do that. They also, you know, for bilberry, they've used artificial food dyes with charcoal to fool a UV, ultraviolet test. Because that's a cheap and fast test to do in the lab. And of course, labs don't want to spend time and money with certain kinds of analytical methods because they take longer to prepare the sample for testing and they take longer to read on the machine and they've got a bunch of other stuff that's waiting to be tested. So, you know, the speed and the cost of testing is an issue, especially if you're sending it out to a third-party lab, because a lot of companies don't have in-house laboratories. They send it out to third-party labs. And they want to go for the cheaper testing. And so what we're trying to do is, and we have a number of labs, the top industry testing labs, third-party industry testing labs in the United States are supporting our organization and supporting this process, this program, because, hey, it's good business for them. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, we're helping them drive more testing. But at the same time, they see what's happening. They can see some of the problems, and they know that it's real. Unfortunately. And so they support what we're doing because we're all out there trying to help ensure that the products that people sell are authentic and give the benefits that people think they're going to get or expect to get. Let me just say one thing also about safety, because you mentioned it earlier. That's why I want to circle back around to that. One of the silver linings, maybe, and I think I use that word very guardedly, about our program is that we have found very few examples of adulteration or fraud that has a safety related issue. Most of the type of adulteration is what we call an economic violation or economic crime, but there's not a situation where it puts people at risk from a safety perspective. There's a few examples that are exceptions, like the occasional adulteration of skullcap with
the germander, right?
The wall germander, yeah, the Tucrium. Yeah. Right. And that's an old one. It was one of the first things we published, by the way. We told
you. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the germander, as you know, is hepatotoxic. It can produce liver toxicity, whereas skullcap, and unfortunately, skullcap has gotten a bad name in some publications because it was believed to be skullcap that produced liver toxicity in some case reports when it wasn't skullcap at all. It was germander. And so, you know, hops and valerian were implicated because hops, valerian, skullcap is an old naturopathic formulation as a natural sedative, right? And it's an old one. So there's been, you know, misreported information that are uncritically pulled out of the literature about potential liver toxicity associated with hops and valerian when there's not any known problem there, really. It's just that they were implicated with this skullcap that really wasn't skullcap, it was germander. But those are some of the few exceptions. Most of the problems we see are not questions of safety or toxicity or liver problems. But the problem, the other problem, the health, there's a health related potential issue. And that is if a person is taking a particular herb or herbal preparation or series of herbal preparations and vitamins and stuff because they're a naturopath or they're an integrative physician or they're herbalist or they're acupuncturist, whatever. Who, depending who they're going to see, has recommended this. Sometimes maybe instead of maybe a pharmaceutical drug regimen, because they're seeing a natural practitioner, if the stuff is adulterated and it's really not there in the quantity or the vitality or the fullness that they expected, it may not give the benefit that the practitioner expected and that the patient is expecting or wanting. And that is the health issue here, in my opinion. It's about not getting the therapeutic benefit, but it's not really about having a safety problem.
Yeah, beautifully said. Yeah, that's a lot to think about, because when patients put their trust in you as a practitioner or a clinician, you want quality stuff that gets the, and that's why, you know, I even, as a clinician, I even go the next level, which is to run the laboratory to see if there's a clinical change in that. Now, of course, there's, that could vary based on many parameters within the body or whatnot, but still, you would expect that if a patient is taking a particular botanical, eventually there'd be some clinical benefit that's, you know, you've seen in the literature or whatever. And so that's kind of taking it to the next clinical step. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Mark Blumenthal. He's executive director of American Botanical Council and publisher of Herbalgram and faculty at various places, and he's done a lot of work and publishing and keeping the industry clean. It's so great to have him on here. Let's talk a little bit about, just backtrack about the business of herbal medicine. And do conventional drug companies feel threatened by herbs? Like, what's the whole politics, as Peter Tosh used to say? Remember the reggae star Peter Tosh with the way he used to say politics?
I like that. Yeah. Well, I don't know how pharmaceutical companies think. I mean, I'm not a pharmaceutical executive, and I've talked to some of them, and I've had various pharmaceutical companies that support our organization, because remember, many of the pharmaceutical companies were once herb companies.
Right.
And still some 25% or more of modern conventional medicines are derived directly or maybe indirectly from plant and plant compounds, maybe up to 50%. So there's a botanical and also fungal base to many modern pharmaceutical drugs, and some of the classic ones that started and came in since around the 1800s. And I'm not one of these conspiracy theorists. I don't think the pharma industry is out to get the herb industry and stuff like that. I've heard a lot of these things from people in the past. I haven't seen any direct evidence, but I haven't looked for it either. It's not, it's a drop in the bucket what the herb industry is doing compared to where they're at. By the way, just as a reporting, we published probably the most complete, extensive, granular herb market report every year in Herbalgram. The last issue of Herbalgram, the current issue, is about the herb market report from 2021. There was a 9.7% increase in total retail herb sales of dietary supplements. That doesn't include teas, doesn't include herb cosmetics. We're just talking herbal supplements. 9.7% increase in 2021 over 2020, and 2020, the first year of the pandemic, consumers went out and bought a bunch of herbs, including elderberry, and there's adulteration there, by the way. We published the very first scientific peer-reviewed article on adulteration of elderberry, and we're working on a bulletin on that. And part of the problem there is because elderberry takes 4 years to fruit. So if you plant elderberry trees or bushes, and you want to get elderberries harvesting to make cough syrup or, you know, whatever out of it, you know, cold flu syrup, it's going to take 4 years or 5 years before you can really get any kind of, so it's not like
we planted some recently and have, we had our first harvest this year. My wife and I made all kinds of great cordials, including this thing that you mix with a gin and tonic, which was really
right. But the point is, you can't just go out and grow a bunch of elderberry in response immediately to increased demand and have it available in 6 months, like you can with many other herbs that are annuals or whatever. You can't do that. But the point is, in 2020, the first year of the pandemic, over 2019, there was a 17% increase in herbal supplement retail sales in the United States in all classes of trade. That's huge. That's a record. So the last 2 years, not including last year, we're not sure yet about all the data, but in 2020 and 2021, there was a 17 and then almost 10% increase in 2 years in successively. A huge outpouring of consumer interest and demand for natural herbs and as natural medicines in many cases. And people were using them not necessarily as COVID therapies, but they were using them as ways to enhance their wellness in order to increase their general immunity. Which makes a lot of sense. You know, I'm a pro-vaxxer. I believe in vaccination. We're a science organization. I don't want to get into that conversation here, but I'm not talking about herbs as a as a therapeutic modality as a alternative to vaccine, but I'm just saying in general, anybody, everybody should be more knowledgeable of the potential benefits of herbs from a perspective of just increasing wellness, increasing immune system function, decreasing stress, etc., from a variety of reasons and a variety of ways to use them. Cold and flus, herbs have been very helpful in helping to ameliorate cold and flus and various kinds of upper respiratory tract infections. And I believe that there's so many different ways that herbs can be useful, as the literature shows, because there's been an explosion in clinical research in the last 30, 40 years on medicinal plants
Yeah,
preparation.
I mean that you brought up a good point. A lot of people, consumers are like, and even doctors, they don't take the time to look up the clinical research, like myself, who's not only a professor emeritus, but writer and teacher, and yourself. But there's good quality studies on herbs that everyone can access by looking at National Library of Medicine, PubMed, and other things like that, right?
If I may, yes, we have a huge database called HerbClip.
Herb clip, yeah.
We've been publishing summaries of clinical research since 1983 or 1984, I believe. And at the end of January this year, we will be publishing our 9,000th HerbClip.
Wow.
So and these are 2 to 3 page summaries of the research. And when the research is done on a specific herb extract or a certain product or ingredient, we describe that. We don't just say the ginger or the ginseng or the garlic. We say what garlic preparation, how it's defined, what company made it, because herbal medicines and herbal preparations are not, they're variable. There's different ones. There's different chemistry in different ones, depending on how they're prepared and stuff like that. One company's product can be chemically different than another company's product on the plant part that they use, or how they prepare the material, etc. So the final chemistry and therefore the pharmacology, the therapeutic benefit can change. So part of the problem in the literature has been that there was a lack of adequate definition and description of what specific material was used in that particular study. And some of the journals have been remiss over the last 20, 30 years in adequately documenting what was actually used by brand if it was a commercial extract. It's important. We always denote that, not to promote the companies that are doing the re that are whose products are in the research, although we have another program for that where we help stimulate and promote the idea that companies should invest in more clinical research on their ingredients and their products, but just to understand the literature and the summary of this particular study or that particular study, what was the study on? If it was ginger, if it was garlic, if it was ginseng, if it was turmeric, whatever it was on, what preparation and how is that preparation defined from a chemical perspective? Because they're not all generic and they can't all be bunched in the same box all the time.
Yeah, definitely. There's so much, and there's a lot of variation in products too, like when the plant was harvested, how it was grown, and climactic. So like for instance, if you're trying to grow ginseng in or Chinese ginseng in Wisconsin, you can do it. It's going to be a little different. You have the American ginseng and the Asian ginseng, but they're like different plants, different chemicals. And I remember once that the industry even said that you can't call other plants ginseng, even though they have ginseng-like properties, adaptogenic properties. So
You
there's
raised 2 points there. One is that is the Chinese tradition where if a plant grows in a certain area,
yeah.
trying to grow it somewhere else will change the energy of the plant that you harvest compared to where it was grown naturally, where it grew. So there's a whole concept around that because a lot of Chinese traditional medicine is based on energetics. Then there's chemistry issues as well. And another thing about is harvesting. Beside harvesting, the way plant materials are processed will affect their chemistry as well. How they're dried, how they're extracted, what kind of extraction medium and what kind of solvents are used, etc. So there's a whole lot of reasons why different herbal products might have a different chemical profiles, and that chemical profile may or may not make one product different in the way it acts compared to another. Now, the point you talked about regarding the name, you said the name ginseng. Ginseng is an overused and misused term. And yes, there's an American ginseng that grows in Wisconsin commercially, and it grew all throughout the Appalachians and up into Canada. And it was the French, the French missionaries that had first made the connection between this plant that the St. Lawrence area Native Americans were using and the plant that was sent to them from one of their missionary brothers from China. And they made the connection that, and they, the first ship that ever left the U.S. colonies to go to China to trade in 1820, I believe it was, contained ginseng, wild American ginseng.
Our ginseng, yeah, Garantoken.
Our ginseng, our wild ginseng.
The Iroquois used to call it Garantoken, which meant
Garantoken, exactly.
Spread apart or something like that, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. But what was happening was there was another plant in the ginseng family, i.e. the Araliaceae, which is the botanical family that the ginseng, Panax ginseng, Panax ginseng is the Chinese Asian variety, Korean ginseng, it's called Panax ginseng, Panax quinquefolius, the five-leaf American ginseng, they're chemically different slightly, and they're used differently. And what happened was there was another product called Eleuthero, called Siberian ginseng in the 70s, that the Russians were using for their cosmonauts and their Olympic team members and in their military. And this so-called Eleuthero, which was a member of the ginseng family but not the genus Panax, was marketed over here in an extract called Siberian ginseng. And that became a catchword for this material that's in the family, but it's not chemically the same. And what happened was it was a lot lower cost than the true Panax ginseng. And it was undercutting a lot of the true ginseng, whether U.S. or mostly Asian, and at that time was Korean or Chinese ginseng, in the marketplace. And it was hurting the sales of the Wisconsin area ginseng growers, because there used to be 150 or more ginseng farms growing ginseng in Wisconsin under shade to kind of simulate the 75% shade of the forest, the Appalachian forest, where ginseng is, and the eastern forest. And they were shipping this stuff mainly to San Francisco or to China. Mostly to China, 80, 90%, probably 95 or 98% of American ginseng exports were sent to China. And they were able to get, in 2004, their congressional group at the time to put into the farm bill, of the 2004 farm bill, which funded the agricultural, expenditures for that year, a rule that said that you could not sell the so-called Siberian ginseng, Eleutherococcus sinicosus, as ginseng, because in fact it really wasn't. It was similar in botany, different in chemistry, and it really isn't ginseng. So in the United States, I think we're the only country in the world that has this law. Eleutherococcus has to be called Eleuthero, which plummeted the sales retail because people didn't recognize what Eleuthero was, didn't have the Siberian ginseng name on it anymore. So people lost interest in it because it wasn't ginseng, it's Eleuthero. And basically, that was really done as a protectionist measure by the Wisconsin delegation to protect their Wisconsin ginseng industry, ginseng growing industry. And it was actually the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do because consumers were being confused and misled, in effect.
There's other herbs like ashwagandha that are very popular now. What's the herb of the year? Like, a lot of times there's kind of herbs of the year that come out that people, being that the year is so young, we have you on here as one of our first guests of the year. What are some of the things to look out for as far as herbs for consumers to hear or be interested?
Well, everybody, I mean, a lot of trade publications have used to write to me all the time and invite me to, you know, predict the herb of the year and all that kind of stuff and what's going to be hot this year.
The Farmer's Almanac. We'll call it the Blumenthal Almanac.
Yeah, and I don't play that game.
Okay.
And there's a reason for that. I'm not into hype. Okay. I'm not into that kind of thing. I'm into the long-term, slow, steady progress of gathering information and communication and education and not going for the short-term peak in the market and the demand because there's a, you know, like what happened in 1997 with the St. John's Wort and it got really big and all of a sudden because, you know, I don't play that way because to me, they all have their place. And there's so much information that's growing about their therapeutic benefits from the scientific and clinical perspective, often confirming some traditional historical uses. So I try to take a more more gentle, maybe relaxed overview of the market and just look at the whole market and just look at, you know, what's healthy here is that people are learning, A, that they have this thing called an immune system. And we have this thing called personal health that we can control some of the way our bodies respond if we look at our diet, our lifestyle, and live more healthily and healthfully. And that includes, but is not limited to, the proper, responsible, judicious use of well-manufactured and properly researched dietary supplements, including, but not limited to, herbs. It's a long statement, but I'm trying to put things into context here. You know, I'm a vegetarian. I've been vegetarian for, I guess this is 55 years now. This is how I got into herbs. I got into it by becoming a vegetarian when I was graduating from college back in 1968. And I'm 76 now. And feeling good and feeling energetic and grateful and happy to be able to be engaged, you know. And it was the vegetarian proposition about learning how to live off of plants that got me interested in herbal medicine. Because, you know, when you start looking at wild edible plants and some of these books about wild edible plants, they say certain plants are potentially poisonous. But interestingly, some of those plants that are poisonous in the wild edible plant books are the herbal medicines in some of the medicine books because you take a smaller dosage of them. You don't eat them like a salad. You just take a little bit because they're more pharmacologically active because they're concentrated or have certain chemicals in there that are not there for food, but they're there for therapeutics. So I got fascinated by that distinction and that opportunity, and I started studying herbs as a hobby. Originally as an avocation. It was just an interesting, I was reading all the herb books I could read. I started off with The Herbalist by Joseph Meyer and John Lust, the herb book, and Back to Eden by Jethro Kloss, and, you know, Stalking the Wild Asparagus by Ewell Gibbons, and, you know, Bradford Angier, and, you know, all that back in the 70s, in the early 70s and late 60s, I started reading these things and they were fascinating. And that's how I got into more of the scientific advocacy part of all this, because I started realizing that there's all this scientific research, a lot of it coming out of Europe, but from India, Japan, China, all over the world, there's been an explosion in scientific and clinical research on natural products and herbal medicines. And we decided that we wanted to be at the forefront and reporting a lot of this, because it was, you know, especially back in the 80s, people just didn't know about it. They would say it's all folklore and old wives' tales, to use an inappropriate term, but that's what they called it. You know, it was just folk medicine, and it was dismissed as having any legitimacy.
Yeah, I remember I would sit during a break studying in the chemistry library, you know, before, like you said, before the internet and things like that in college. And I remember going through the volumes and coming across this journal called Lloydia, and just opening up and seeing all the chemistry of the herbs. I'm like, why isn't my chemistry professor teaching this? Why aren't there any courses in this? If you want it, that opened my eyes. And of course, my whole journey, you know, in Jamaica studying with shaman and working, you know, doing ethnobotanical stuff, that all, but I always wanted to look at the science, and finding these journals in the stacks. Remember the I used to go to the stacks and take them out and photocopy and have a bag of nickels.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned Lloydia, because Lloydia is a journal named for the famous pharmacist and eclectic pharmacist John Uri Lloyd of Lloyd Brothers Pharmacy of Cincinnati. And the Lloyd Library today in Cincinnati at Plum and Court Street in downtown Cincinnati is the largest library of medicinal plant research in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, it's famous. The Lloydia Journal became the Journal of Natural Products. That's its current name. It's a famous journal. It's one of the top journals in the world on medicinal plant research. And I'm very grateful to say that our major 15,000 word article with over 100 or 200 references in it on how adulterators are trying to deceive analytical methods by through fraud. That article, we just got notice yesterday from JNP, formerly Lloydia, that our paper is peer-reviewed, has been accepted for publication sometime in the next month or two in that journal. So we'll be putting out a press release about that with a link, because we're going to have to pay several thousand dollars to get it free access, because it's behind the firewall. You have to be an American Chemical Society member or a Journal of Natural Product subscriber. But we're going to make it available for the public to use, like all of our other publications in the adulterants prevention program, as well as all of our videos in the sustainable herbs program, which we hadn't even talked about yet, you know, but we're going to make that available to the public, but we have to pay extra for that. And, you know, it's expensive to run an organization. We have over 50 people working with ABC, like 19 employees and like over 30 or 35 contractor editors, writers, consultants, et cetera. So we're a member-based nonprofit at herbalgram.org. We're open to the public. We have a huge website. We have one of the largest non-commercial websites on herbal medicine. It's full of information at herbalgram.org, and people are invited to come check it out. And there's a lot of free information at herbalgram.org. About 20% of what we publish is in front of the firewall and free for anybody who wants it.
And then folks can actually get it. Subscription and enjoy the fantastic magazine that, like that other folk that you said before, I haven't thrown out any of mine too. I have them all. It's one of the magazines I keep in my study. So tell us a little bit about how people can find more about what you're doing. In the last, we have about 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. Well, at herbalgram.org, we're the American Botanical Council. We're an independent nonprofit research and education organization. We have members in 81 countries around the world, I believe. We don't sell subscriptions per se. We have memberships, and people can, for as little as $50, you can become a member. We have a weekly newsletter that we put out for anybody. You can just register on our website. You don't even have to join. You can register on our website at herbalgram.org, and you get a weekly newsletter called Herbal News and Events, which has all kinds of information on webinars, conferences, etc., some of the media from the previous week, and summaries of articles that have been published, all kinds of information. And we have Herbalgram, the beautiful award-winning publication that's four color. Everything that we publish is available online and at different levels of membership. We have academic memberships at 100, professional memberships at 150. We have corporate memberships that start at different levels for people in the industry. So we're a member-based organization with members all over the world, because herbal medicine is an international phenomenon. It's part of our heritage. We've inherited this from our grandmothers and grandfathers going back since the beginning of time, the beginning of society. People have passed down the knowledge of how to use plants as food, for fiber, for fragrance, for shelter, for medicine, for magic, for religious purposes. We focus on the medicine, and we focus on the scientific research that we help promote and stimulate and report on in the area of herbal medicine and natural medicine. And there's a growing body of this data. And so we collect and compile information on the human clinical research. We don't report on chemical studies or animal studies or in vitro studies. There's thousands of those. You just can't keep up with all that. And we're about human clinical studies, basically.
And it's a good launching point for people that are interested in herbal medicine, and they want to really understand how the industry works. That was great that you kind of pieced together how an herb is grown, manufactured, captured, picked, harvested, and then goes all the way through to the point where you at the health food store are looking at it and saying, I would like to try this. Now, of course, there's a myriad brands out there when you go on the internet, so it's nice to know a little bit about what to look for quality brands and other brands and markers and standardization. Not that all that occurs, but I think the adulteration is important, I think.
Right, and I mean, it's also sustainability. In the remaining moment, I want to just clarify. We have a program called the Sustainable Herbs Program. It's a website available from our ABC herbalgram.org website. And the Sustainable Herbs Program is free access, and it consists of right now over 50 videos, maybe more, that are freely available about answering the question, where do your herbs come from? Do you know where your herbs come from? And do you know why it's important and why it matters? And who were the people in various countries at the very beginning who are picking or growing or processing by hand, in many cases, these materials that end up sooner or later into herbal extracts, capsules, tablets, cosmetics, whatever? It's important to know, and what are the sustainability factors, not only for them as humans, but what's the planetary future with global warming and the climate crisis for the future availability of many of the herbs that we've grown to depend on over the last hundreds and thousands of years.
But plus, as more people get into herbal medicines, there's that whole sustainability issue too. Like, can we really, you know, grow enough echinacea to help everybody? Or
the answer to that is yes. Echinacea is easy to grow, especially purpurea. So the answer to that one's an easy one. Echinacea would be a no-brainer. There's other ones though. Look, what about rhodiola? Rhodiola is a alpine plant in northern, you know, it's arboreal up in the Arctic Circle, and it's been just listed by CITES, the Convention on Trade in Endangered Species, as at risk potentially. So especially with climate temperatures rising, some of these arboreal and alpine plants are at risk.
Yeah, so knowing where the herb grows and what climate they're in and whether they're endangered is other information that consumers need to know, and they could access that through your wonderful publication and website, Mark.
Yeah. Yes, we have a very large and very active sustainability program, the Sustainable Herbs Program, where we have a number of really forward-thinking and responsible industry members that are underwriting that whole program.
What's nice, too, is you also do a nice tribute to herbal giants that have passed on in the memorial section, which I think is very nice because you can read about the scientist or the herbalist or the doctor's life. I still have a necktie from when Dr. Tyler retired. It was a special Ginkgo Gucci tie because I was invited to one of his things. It was just amazing. So I still wear that to it's my power tie. I know you don't wear a tie too much, but.
No, I never found that wearing ties increased my intelligence or ability to process information. Yeah. The cutting off my circulation to my brain was not conducive to increasing my quality of life.
Well, Happy New Year, Mark. I appreciate your amazing program here to get us started on Natural Nurse and Dr. Z and the Natural House Call. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dr. Z, for including me.
Leave us with one cool herbal thought or one philosophical thought from the Blumenthal.
Real, how about this? Real easy. People use herbs for one simple reason, because they work.
Ah, very good. I'm wearing my t-shirt in honor of that. I've got an herb for that. So, all right. Take good care and many blessings. We'll be in touch.
Thank you, Gene. Appreciate it.
Sure. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We want you to stay healthy, folks. Bye.